Retail analysts, Federal Reserve bankers, well, people are asking the question,
is the recovery petering out?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, July 14th. Where is this economy headed?
Also, we'll have a story about California and facelifts, although it's not what you think, and what to do with the fish that's invading Midwest waterways. I'll give you a hint there. The answer has to do with shipping. But first,
the Federal Reserve is concerned about how our economy is growing. It's expected to come out with a report today saying the recovery might be pretty limp. With more, we turn to the Wall Street Journal's John Hilzenrath. He broke the story. Hi, John.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. What are the rumblings coming from the Fed?
Well, so we're going to be getting minutes this afternoon from the Fed's last meeting in late June.
Yeah.
And what we're going to learn in those minutes is that they've downgraded their forecast for economic growth in the second half of the year and into 2011, and that they've started a debate. You know, they spent most of the beginning of this year talking about how to exit from their easy money policies. Now they're starting to wonder, maybe we should be doing more.
And you know, a lot of these a lot of the board is seeing the same information, right? I mean, is this a matter of interpretation?
There's disagreements at the board about what they're seeing and about what they should do. There are people at the Fed who worry a lot about inflation, and then there are people at the Fed who worry about deflation. The ones who worry about deflation, which is, you know, falling prices, are starting to think maybe we should be doing more. But there's disagreements there, too, not only on whether they should, but on how effective it would be. There's not a lot they could do. Interest rates are already near zero. Last year, they went out and bought more than $1 trillion worth of mortgage bonds and treasury debt, and they could do more of that. But there's disagreements among these Fed officials about how effective that would be. Interest rates are already pretty low. There's not much more farther they could push them down.
The Wall Street Journal's John Hilzenrath with us from Washington. John, thanks.
Okay.
Sales at U.S. retailers fell for a second month in June. The Commerce Department reported today weak car and gasoline sales were mostly to blame. Analysts expected a smaller dip. So let's turn to our Wednesday morning regular economist, Richard DeKayser of Woodley Park Research. He's with us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Richard.
Morning, Bill.
I mentioned sales at U.S. retailers fell last month, but you were telling me that those numbers look worse than they actually are. Why is that?
Well, that's right. We have a variety of special factors, and they're weighing heavily on these results. Specifically, everyone's familiar with the tax credits for housing, which has expired in the spring. Well, with that goes a downturn in housing, but also furniture sales. They were off sharply. We also saw a big decline in building materials, and there were huge incentives for people to purchase things like energy-efficient appliances, which they did in March and April, but we're now seeing the fall off after that. And then finally, we had an expiration of unemployment benefits for those of long-term unemployment, and that translated into about a loss of $300 million in spending power and is probably showing up in some of the results like grocery stores.
Okay. Thanks for the update, the economic picture. Richard DeKayser, president of Woodley Park Research. Good to talk to you.
My pleasure.
And one more economic bulletin. Demand for home loans just hit a 13-year low, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association this morning. Those are loans to buy homes. Refinancing loans have fared a little better with mortgage rates being so low. Earnings season is underway. How much companies are making could tell us a lot about this economic recovery, and it looks like one of the bright spots will be the technology sector. Yesterday, the chipmaker Intel said it earned almost $3 billion last quarter, and other tech companies are expected to show profits. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to explain what's going on with tech.
In spite of the recent volatility on Wall Street, analyst Mike Raimondi at IHS Global Insight says technology companies have performed consistently well.
You do have tech stocks that are surging.
Raimondi says this is partly just the upside of corporate downsizing.
They've shed a lot of their cost, slimmed down, gotten rid of a lot of people, so their earnings look much better.
And Raimondi says even with the recovery faltering, sales of high-tech equipment continue to strengthen. He predicts they'll be up 6% this year, nearly 10% in 2011. Carl Howe is a technology analyst with the Yankee Group. He says businesses that put off upgrades during the recession are now going shopping.
eventually you've got to replace some of the gear you bought several years ago.
And when that new gear helps your company become more profitable, all the better.
People use technology to make themselves more productive.
So even if people hold back on most consumer spending, Howe says, they'll still keep upgrading their smartphones and laptops every time a new model comes out. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, July 14th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. Smaller American banks, those with assets below $100 billion, are less likely to be able to repay money from the Troubled Asset Relief Program. That is the latest warning from the Congressional Oversight Panel, out with its monthly report on TARP today. Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren chairs the panel. She's with us now. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Now, if TARP, Professor, was supposed to help the entire financial system recover, why then are smaller banks still feeling such pain?
Well, the smaller banks, in part, have been hit a little later in the crisis. It took them a very long time to get TARP money, and 15% have already missed at least one of their dividend payments, suggesting that they're in real financial distress.
So then, what are the threats to smaller banks?
Well, smaller banks are facing big losses in commercial real estate. The amount they have to pay in the dividends on TARP will rise sharply. And they are, quite frankly, at a competitive disadvantage to try to go into the market and raise capital because they're competing against banks that have an implicit guarantee, the too big to fail banks.
Why not have a Citibank on every street corner and forget about the smaller banks?
Well, small banks are important to our financial system for two reasons. One is they disproportionately take care of the lending to small businesses. Also, there's a notion that a diversified banking system, a system that has some big banks and some small banks and banks in different parts of the country, will be more robust and less likely to tumble when there are economic problems.
So what's the solution here?
Well, the best thing I can say is that this report flags a problem for Treasury. So there's some time for Treasury to rethink this program and, quite bluntly, to work out a plan to deal with the banks that are not going to be able to repay and to think about how they can be structured or, unfortunately, how they can be closed.
Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel. Thank you so much, Professor.
You're welcome.
Today, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce holds a job summit across the street from the White House, which is a dig at what the business lobby calls a failed summit the Obama administration put on last December. Reporter Kathy Ducham has more.
What's the best way to create jobs? And the uncertainty about the economy. That's according to the U.S. Chamber's Stan Anderson. He says lingering questions lead businesses to hold back on making investments.
They're concerned that we may be going back into a double-dip recession.
Anderson says the Obama administration needs to take action, sign trade agreements to boost exports, ease up on new regulations, and most important, don't let those Bush administration tax cuts expire. Economist Joshua Shapiro with MFR Financial says low taxes are good, but there's no quick fix.
The problem is that a lot of this requires just patience and an understanding that, you know, we didn't get ourselves into this mess overnight and we're not going to get out of it overnight.
But with midterm elections this fall, there's no such thing as patience. I'm Kathy Ducham for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to get a take on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects the United States. Earlier today, Singapore predicted its economy will grow by 15% this year, fastest pace in the world. The BBC's Catherine Bierahanga reports on why that could be good news for Americans.
Singapore's economy relies heavily on exports, and as one of the most export-reliant countries in Asia, it's often seen as a barometer for world demand. So the news that it's seen record expansion already this year could be encouraging news across the world. But with high unemployment in the US and Europe struggling to reduce huge budget deficits, there are concerns that Singapore is being too confident. Hugh Young is the managing director of Aberdeen Asset Management in Asia.
For Singapore, the outlook for the West has to be a concern. But a lot of what Singapore does is for the Asian region itself, and the Asian region itself still is growing at quite a strong rate.
Although the Singapore government expects the second half of this year to be tougher, it thinks that a double-dip recession is unlikely. In London, I'm the BBC's Catherine Bierahanga for Markets Place.
A European Union decision this morning means essentially that British Airways and American Airlines will function as one on their transatlantic routes. That means when you book a flight on one airline, you could very well be flying on the other. Marketplace's Europe correspondent Stephen Beard is with us live from London to talk about why this is such a big deal. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So the two airlines are already in an alliance, right? I mean, what's new with today's decision?
This will get them working even more closely together, coordinating flights and fares, running joint frequent flyer programs, for example. They say they need to do this to cut costs at a time when many airlines are still losing money. The U.S. regulator, by the way, still has got to have its say, but it's expected to give its blessing.
And why is that? Why do we need regulatory approval for this? Why couldn't they just sign a deal on their own?
BA's rivals argue that this alliance will push up transatlantic airfares. BA says this is nonsense. There have been similar transatlantic alliances running for some years now, Air France and Delta, for example. So they say it would be illogical to block this alliance. Airline industry observers say if this was virtually any other global industry which needs to consolidate, there would be transatlantic mergers. I mean, BA would be taking over American or vice versa. But David Learmount, editor of Flight Global magazine, says that isn't going to happen soon.
At the moment, the world still has not got its head around that idea. And the biggest opponent of the idea of having airlines which are not national is the United States of America.
Mm. Now, Stephen, is this just a first step? Could we see a transatlantic merger?
Well, you tell me. I mean, that's you're where the opposition is. I mean, the U.S. feels that airlines based in the U.S. need to be American for security reasons. Many Europeans, however, say that's not the case. In time of a national emergency, for example, any government can commandeer any airline operating in its territory.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, July 14th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Toyota now says that at least some of those unintended acceleration crashes may have been the driver's fault. It was just a couple of months ago Toyota recalled about 8 million vehicles after those malfunctions. Alisa Roth covers the auto industry for Marketplace, and she joins us live. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Toyota says the crashes were the driver's fault. How did it come to that conclusion?
Well, Toyota's been looking into all these claims very carefully. Not a surprise there. What's a little more surprising is that so far it says in most of the cases, it's found that the driver was actually flooring the accelerator instead of jamming on the brakes. Now, this isn't just Toyota's word against the drivers. The U.S. government's also been doing some investigating, and although it hasn't officially released those results yet, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the feds are finding the same thing.
So what are we saying here, Alisa, that the charges against Toyota were a mistake and they're off the hook?
Well, in some ways, probably. These findings will certainly help Toyota's legal fights. You remember that the company's being sued all over the place for accidents that people say were caused by unintended acceleration. Unfortunately for Toyota, there are still documented cases of problems that were the vehicle's fault. So there were the sticky accelerator pedals, those floor mats that were getting caught under pedals. They had software problems in some of their hybrids. And all of those point to some serious management issues within Toyota, both in terms of how the company was dealing with those problems, but even at a very basic PR level.
So in summation, Elisa, do you think these latest findings restore Toyota's reputation?
I think in some measure it's going to depend how Toyota handles this round. I mean, it got really low marks for its crisis management the first time, and it may just be too late on the PR front. Years ago, Audi had a similar problem with unintended acceleration, and in that case, it really was driver error that was causing the problems, but it took close to a decade for Audi to recover from that one.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth, thank you.
You're welcome.
The oldest freeway in the car-loving state of California sits right outside our Marketplace studios, and it is showing its age. The road is getting some much-needed structural repairs, but reporter Eve Tro says it's also getting cosmetic work done, and with California in a budget crisis, that has raised some eyebrows.
The Pasadena Freeway hasn't changed much since it was built 60 years ago, with narrow lanes made for slower cars. Today, it's an infamous Los Angeles driving challenge. Just getting on it is harrowing. It doesn't have on-ramps, only stop signs.
All right, passenger has to be lookout, okay?
All right, after the second car here. All right, go, 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 go,
okay,
go.
Okay, okay.
My God.
Rico and I made it on okay, but that's just the beginning of this road's issues.
There's places where there's no fencing, there's places where there's no walls, where it just looks like it's abandoned.
Dolly Colorado has lived most of her life near this freeway on the east side of L.A. She's thrilled the government is spending $17 million to make it safer, with new medians and concrete sidewalls, because she likes the ride.
You can see the river, there's all this greenery, there's all these parks.
It's so pretty. The road's been named a National Scenic Byway. And that means another change. The Pasadena Freeway is going back to its maiden name, the Arroyo Seco Parkway. All the signs have to be changed. It's costing taxpayers $650,000. A lot of Angelenos say that's way too much, like Jackie Gibson.
Did we vote on it? I didn't. I mean, there's better things we can do with that $650,000.
But the California Department of Transportation says the money came from a grant earmarked only for this project. Judy Gish is a spokesperson.
Funds from the Federal Highway Administration would not be able to be diverted to be used to fund schools.
Resident Dolly Colorado agrees it's expensive, but she sees how the new, old name could attract visitors.
Open up Sunset Magazine and it's like, come to historic Arroyo Seco Parkway, you know.
But, she says, probably only tourists would call it that. Locals will likely keep using the road's least romantic moniker, the 110. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
And finally, the state of Illinois has had quite a problem with Asian carp, an invasive species in its waterways, eating up everything, other fish and fish food.
Well, the state's going to send up to 30 million pounds of the carp to China, where it can be served at upscale restaurants.
The new export agreement signed by Governor Pat Quinn will increase the amount of fish already being shipped to Asia.
Said the governor, if you can't beat them, eat them.
Truer today than when it was written.
Oh, certainly. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.